Welcome to Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. This week on Making Contact.
It's with the knowledge that our parents' generation brings and the experience, especially the discipline of organizing tactics, with the very courageous, flamboyant actions on the front lines of people willing to risk their lives doing these blockades, locking themselves to bulldozers and things like that.
We're not just shaking a fist at the sky and yelling at the converted, but we're really trying to reach out to people, and really we just need inroads into figuring out how we can enter the arena of social change work.
Tired of the same old demonstration, placards and marches, speeches and chants? On this program, you'll hear from activists who are devising new ways to get their messages out to the public, raising awareness about issues of social justice. I'm Philip Babbitt, your host this week on Making Contact. Since social activism typically challenges the status quo, organizers have the daunting task of not only presenting alternative information, but also breaking through the boundaries of conventional wisdom. According to Daniel Singer, contributing editor and European correspondent for The Nation magazine, one pervasive concept promoted by supporters of what's called free trade is that there's no alternative to global capitalism.
Power rests partly on our impotence, on our acceptance, and on our resignation. As capitalism spreads across the planet, nobody bothers any longer to present the system as a sort of social democratic paradise on earth. How could they, when the gap between the haves and the have-nots is widening all over the place? In the circumstances, they don't even bother to pretend. But with the help of the mighty propaganda machine at their disposal, they found a better parade. You don't have to love the system. You just have no choice. There is no alternative. That is the slogan of our time. But times are changing. You may recall the French winter of discontent, the strikes and mass demonstrations that surprised the world at the end of 1995. What was fascinating to watch at the time, I mean, that was true in Paris, on the little screen was the panic of our pundits and our preachers, who repeated their usual incantation about the market, about Maastricht, about the IMF, and the louder they shouted, the bigger the movement grew. What was so frightening for them was the contempt of the millions of marchers for the usual argument, there is no alternative. The message of the movement was plain. If that is the future you offer us, to hell with your future, alternative or no alternative. It is this process that we must now reverse, restoring the belief that life can be altered by changing society through collective political action. In other words, by forging a radical alternative.
Daniel Singer, contributing editor for The Nation magazine. He spoke last year at the Socialist Scholars Conference held in New York City and was recorded by Roger Leisner of Radio Free Maine. With changes in technology and political climate, some of today's activists are looking for new tactics to promote social justice. Correspondent Travis Lee spoke with activists from two generations about current organizing strategies.
Now in his 40s, Stephen Dunifer has spent many years active in political movements. But for the past 7 years, he's tried a new approach, unlicensed micro-powered broadcasting in an effort to provide uncensored, uncompromised information to activist movements. Dunifer, who builds and ships out the tiny FM transmitters to activists across the country and around the globe, says in the past there didn't used to be as many resources available to activists.
We had a lot more tools available to us than we did at that time. We have, you know, pretty much ubiquitous means of communication, such as fax machines, computers, the internet. All these things can be used very effectively, and if people, you know, so choose to use those tools. And now, of course, we have micropower broadcasting as well. I don't think that we have any particular, you know, unifying vision, which I think is part of our problem, that we let political differences get in our way. We let territorial, so to speak, differences get in our way. We really can't see the common vision because of a variety of reasons.
Forming coalitions in a splintered progressive community seems to be more and more appealing as transnational corporations move to dominate the global economy. Some young people who are frustrated with the oppression they face in jobs, school, and in their communities want to be active, but some perceive the older strategies of their parents' generation to be at least partially outdated. Alicia Littletree is a 23-year-old organizer for Earth First, a hardline environmental group that wages long, direct action campaigns against unsustainable logging and other eco-troubles. Earth First is remarkable, not only for its ability to organize very young people in a community setting and set them on a road to a politically active life, but also for the level of innovation the group brings to its activism. Earth Firsters chain themselves to logging equipment and construct enormous tripods out of logs in which they perch themselves to block logging roads. Their energy and discipline in organization is dazzling, as is the persistence of their months-long campaigns. I asked Littletree if she thought Earth First could have the same energy it does without the participation of so many young people.
Absolutely not. No way. I mean, it's like, it is. It's the idealism. And the it's not innocence, but it's, you know, Earth First sprang out of reactionary environmental politics. It was the alternative to that. It was the hard line, no compromise. And I think that the refusal to compromise is prevalent mostly in our generation, you know, in the younger generation. Our generation is going to grow older, and it's going to be, we're going to learn as we start to come of age that then again these 17 and 18 year olds are toeing the line and really pushing it further and further. And
how do you feel about an older brand of activism that we've been seeing, you know, for more than a generation now, of, you know, as I was saying, of our parents' generation? Do you feel that kind of activism still has the same impact?
No, actually, I think that we're most effective when we combine the wisdom of our parents' generation with the freshness and the perspective of our generation. I mean, we've got people, it's certainly not all 20-year-olds up in the Redwood struggle. It's, you know, Judy Berry was 47 when she passed away last year, and she was one of our primary strategists and spokespeople. And it's with the knowledge that our parents' generation brings and the experience, especially the discipline of organizing tactics, because we've got, you know, the same tactics. I hear people, you know, especially people my age, saying, oh, we got to try something new, we got to do something new, this doesn't work. And over again, it just comes back to, well, you know, if we really are disciplined about employing these organizing tactics, you know, just doing the information, you know, getting information out and, you know, keeping the mailing list and all that stuff, it's hand in hand with the very courageous, flamboyant actions on the front lines of people willing to risk their lives doing these blockades, locking themselves to bulldozers and things like that. But the thing that's the super powerful coalition between their generation and our generation is that now they are entrenched in the community. They have, you know, maybe they have land, maybe they have jobs, they have children. They are in a position where they need to, you know, they can't necessarily go out on the front lines for 2 months the way that we can. But I think it's a mistake for us to say, well, if they're not out on the front lines, they have nothing to offer to us. I think it's a real partnership.
Littletree stresses that the pervasive sense of hopelessness that characterizes today's youth has contributed to the militancy in new breeds of activism. She says the same no-compromise, tough-love attitude young people have grown up with in jobs and in school transfers over to actions of protest. But perhaps most significantly, says Little Tree, today's youth have grown up in the absence of community due to a lack of jobs and a breakdown in families. She says building communities is the first step in building activist movements.
Earth First really has this incredible culture of resistance. I mean, we have our own music that comes from our struggle. We have, you know, just a cultural understanding. At times, I think people coming into our struggle, there's kind of an adaptation period. You know, we almost even have our own language to a certain level. We all take on these forest names and, you know, which some people think is kind of silly, but there's a real unity. And not only that, in our base camps, kind of the basis of the direct action struggle as it's evolved is that we have actual areas where people can live, plan actions, do actions. Then there's a tight jail support collective, getting people through the system and out of it and to their court dates and things like that. And this whole kind of little mini society that we've created within the camps and within our organizational structure, it's very different. And for some people, it's the first exposure to community on that level that they ever get. And I really think that's revolutionary. I think that can revolutionize and radicalize people when they come into our struggle. So.
Progressives may find Alicia Littletree's upbeat approach refreshing, but it's often just as easy to get discouraged by the apparent languor and apathy of many of today's youth. Young people are more likely to gather at a rave or an underground dance party before even thinking about a rally or a protest. But there are some young musicians who are trying to break the mold of indulgence and apathy by taking the thriving club culture to a higher level of social awareness.
Honor your father, honor your planet, honor your brothers and sisters, honor each other. One love, one bond between all people. No matter what your color, no matter what your race, your creed, your culture, your preference, your pride, rise and come together with one love. You hear me? It's a call for mercy for all our sins. You dig?
San Francisco-based house musicians Dub Tribe have been delivering uplifting tunes for about 7 years. The husband and wife duo Sunshine and Moonbeam Jones say they've witnessed the same sense of hopelessness and solitude that Alicia Littletree describes. So they've attempted to bring a message of self-awareness and caring to a scene which witnesses many teens searching, sometimes with the aid of drugs, for a more positive future. And like Littletree, they say community building is the first step.
I do think just the nature of people gathering to celebrate dance and life and each other, that in and of itself, although hedonistic, is definitely a statement of activism because it's proactive. House music in and of itself is an activist art form because it isn't pop music. It doesn't come and get you, yet it is dance music. So it's all about you and what you're going to do, because there's no spectacle involved in a guy spinning records. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot more involved, and it's a great arena. It really is a great platform to spring mm-hmm. forth from. But in and of itself, no, I don't think rave is activism.
Because I think that a lot of activist movements, though, spring from the environment of the rave. I think that it is, you know, whether it be accidental or you know, to some degree planned, I think young people find, you know, a house or a rave or something, and they go, and they get inspired. And I think, I don't know, not everybody has that epiphany, but...
Most people do.
I think at some point or another, I think everyone does, and they find that they want to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And because we get approached constantly by people who are doing benefits and supporting, you know, be it Indian tribes or Earth First, yeah. Variety of political causes, which is fantastic. And I think that you know, the more that kind of thing happens, I think that rave is a great forum for that, and much more positive mm-hmm. than just, you know, some dude trying to make a couple of $1,000 on a Saturday night. Yeah.
I really think that it's a farming ground. It's a place mm-hmm. for seed planting. It's almost like high school for activists.
Dub Tribe tries to keep in touch with its alumni by circulating a newsletter replete with concert information and positive vibes. Under the banner The Ministry of Love, Dub Tribe has circulated anonymous flyers with messages of peace and understanding, always dwelling more on the personal plane than on the societal one. And apparently, underground music gatherings are scaring the establishment. Dub Tribe complains that laws in Florida, Atlanta, and San Jose, California forbid dancing after a certain hour. Indeed, across the Atlantic, Great Britain passed the Criminal Justice Act in 1994, which forbids groups larger than a dozen from gathering to dance, except in nightclubs. Since the passage of the act, raves have played an active role in gathering protesters for militant, eco-inspired road raves held on new overpasses that protest the construction of new highways and the destruction of the environment. For Making Contact, I'm Travis Lee.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. This program can now be heard on over 120 stations in the United States, Canada, Haiti, and South Africa, and around the world on Radio for Peace International Shortwave. If you want to get in touch with any of the organizations you hear about on this program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes or transcripts, or if you have a comment or suggestions for future programs. That's 800-529-5736.
Art and theater have also played a role in today's activism. Making Contact's Denise Grob has more.
Famed anarchist and labor activist of the late 1800s and early 1900s, Emma Goldman once said, "Every stimulus which quickens the imagination and raises the spirits is as necessary to our life as air. It invigorates the body and deepens our vision of human fellowship." Goldman's sentiment resonates today for a variety of activists and artists across the United States who are using art to change their communities and the world.
There's a whole movement happening out there, people trying to change things.
Andrew Boyd is with the Boston-based United for a Fair Economy, an economic justice organization that has recently published a book about creative organizing titled The Activist Cookbook.
It's not a real cookbook. It's an activist cookbook, and it's full of creative ideas for making your message heard in this media-saturated world. For those people that really care about what's happening to the average American and how corporate America is making off with a bucket load of money at our expense. This is full of the best creative direct actions, street theater, and media stunts. We scoured the country for the best of these, and we put them all together in one place in this cookbook.
Boyd describes some of the book's recipes.
We have for example, a corporate soup kitchen. You know, we try to take something simple that people understand, like a soup kitchen, and then turn it on its head and add something new and surprising. So instead of this being an average soup kitchen, this is a soup kitchen where the government is doling out huge corporate subsidies to needy corporations. And you may not know this, but the government gives out approximately $200 billion a year to corporations. So we do a soup kitchen which exposes that practice in a very fun kind of a way. Another piece, for example, very easy one to understand, again, a sweatshop fashion show, taking fashion shows that everybody loves, but instead of supermodels in their, barely clad, silk dresses for $10,000, it's garments made in sweatshops. And, that's very funny, and people love to do fashion shows, and yet it has a very critical edge and gets the issues out. For example, a piece we do on the street is, or that other groups have done, we haven't actually done this, is called In Bed with Big Business. And you take a bed on wheels and you put two people in it, someone in government that you're trying to show how they're in cahoots with big business, and the big business person who's currently buying them off, and you wheel this bed right up onto the steps of the legislature and you do a media event there. And you say, we want this reform legislation and, we're going to stay on the steps until we get what we want. So that's an example. Another simple piece is a part of like using a sporting event. Everybody loves sports. Everybody thinks in sporting terms. So we do a two-wage earner relay race where two people in this, husband and wife are passing back and forth their kid, like in a doll, like as if it was a baton in a relay race. And you do that as a stage piece, or you can do it outside.
Another group that is engaged in creative organizing tactics is Art and Revolution Convergence, a collective based in California. Ali Chagi Star is a collective member.
Art and Revolution's mission is really to demarginalize political protests and make politics more accessible to a wider audience. We build giant puppets, we make music, theater, and dance for street demonstrations, and we also teach organizing skills and street theater to organizations who want to build their movement through artistic and more visionary means. Part of why we feel that this work is so valid right now is that we find that combining art and politics is incredibly strategic on both fronts, that our art, as I always tell people, really suffers, I think, without a political and social relevance in the same way that our politics really suffers without a creative and a visionary spirit behind it. So, and I think the two are should be as seen as married and together and shouldn't have been separated to begin with.
Art and Revolution works with labor unions, environmental organizations, peace groups, and a variety of social change movements. This past year, the collective helped organize campaigns with over 20 groups, including the United Farm Workers and Earth First.
I think the mission of Art and Revolution is to do justice work and to work with a wide range of justice and social change organizations. And I think the key here is that a lot of these issues are really connected, that for me, whether they're dumping toxic waste or nuclear waste on native land or killing political environmentalists in Nigeria, it's the same issue. It's still a few corporations and very rich people benefiting off of the suffering and, you know, the exploitation of others and the planet itself. So the same thing would go for, you know, the deforestation issue. The same thing would go for, you know, strike breaking. All of these activities, which seem diverse and maybe not connected, we see are inherently connected. So what I think is so strategic about our work with Art and Revolution is that we are bridging a lot of communities, and in the place where people would have written us off as, oh, those crazy protesters and marginalized us, or we marginalized ourselves. Instead, what we're doing is through the giant puppets and the colorful celebrations and the festivals in the street and the music, people can relate. Kids can relate. People come up, you know, people come from across the street and say, hey, what's going on here? And they want to hear about the issues. And we're not just shaking a fist at the sky and yelling at the converted, but we're really trying to reach out to people and say that these things are important, that we all care about the suffering of our planet. We all care about, you know, the exploitation of other peoples, and really we just need inroads into figuring out how we can enter the arena of social change work.
One collective that is combining the goals of art, education, and social change with youth empowerment is the Cell Space, a 10,000 square foot community warehouse in San Francisco. The Cell Space hosts an art gallery, classrooms, artist studios, wood, and metal shops. Jonathan Ute, a co-founder and caretaker for the Cell Space, describes its mission and activism.
It's a cooperative of artists and teachers that got together about 2 years ago to form a shared space where we could come together and do creative work as well as gathering and kind of education through process. Like, instead of just classes and workshops, we learn by doing. So there's a lot of apprenticing going on, and just, you know, projects that are, you know, based out of Cell, that learning happens naturally. Currently, our neighborhood is becoming gentrified. We've got live-work loft, luxury loft spaces that are being built, not for artists, but for people who buy art. And they don't really have any clear mission to connect with the community and the neighborhood that's here. They're more interested in finding parking for their Volvos and you know, Range Rovers. What we're doing is we're basically building alliances with as many community groups as possible. We really feel like collaborative work is the only way to have a stronghold in this neighborhood and any neighborhood that's becoming gentrified. So what we've got right now is a proposal out with the juvenile justice system, where we would become a rehabilitation site for youth in who've currently been involved in some kind of criminal activity, and we would be a placement site for them to learn about arts and vocational arts. So it wouldn't just be art for art's sake, it would be art for learning's sake and art to sell.
Ute adds that the Cell Space has struggled to find a balance between its egalitarian, collaborative vision and the need for economic survival.
We're different from other arts groups that sometimes tend to shy away from making, you know, money because they don't want to sell out. We're realizing that you got to sell out to one extent in order to survive. And I think that that's a balance we're trying to strive for, is how do you maintain these ideals and these principles that are about a balance and about equality and egalitarianism, and still work within a system that supports capitalism and a profit. So I think what the proposal that we have out is to form a cooperative, a producing cooperative, where everyone from the youth to the adults making the work would be equal members in this cooperative. And as we find places to sell our work, we would all have an equal representation in what to do with the profits generated from that work. So that's the balance that we've kind of arrived at. And I think that it'll empower the youth like they've never been empowered before, because at no point have they been equals with adults. And I think this will be a rare opportunity for them to have a voice.
While Andrew Boyd of United for a Fair Economy is enthusiastic about the marriage of art and activism, Boyd stresses that this approach doesn't have to be and shouldn't be shocking for the average American.
In terms of the sort of line between, say, shocking and inviting people in with a sort of a creative approach, I think that's very important, and people need to take sort of approach that very responsibly. And the idea is not to shock. I mean, that's self-indulgent. That's, you're doing that for yourself to make some kind of point, to maybe put distance between you and your audience because you don't identify with them. That's not what we do. And you know, people are already in shock. People are already in shock because of the economic situation that they're facing, and that's not at all what you want to do. What you want to do is do something that's engaging, that's perceived in a friendly way, maybe not, you know, completely, you know, that might take people by surprise and invite curiosity and intrigue, be intriguing, and not something that you may not be able to figure out immediately, okay? But that's very inviting and engaging and friendly, and uses maybe a familiar form, like we were saying before, like a game show or a sporting event or a fashion show, but turns it around. And you also want to play. You want to play. Respect the intelligence of your audience. You don't want to spoon feed them. You don't want it to be so cut and dry that it's boring. So, you know, with any craft, there's a dance you have to do around how to make it both communicate and make it beautiful.
Andrew Boyd of United for a Fair Economy, which has recently published The Activist Cookbook, a written ensemble of creative social change organizing happening at the national and international levels. For Making Contact, I'm Denise Grob.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at creative organizing. Thanks for listening. And special thanks this week to Peggy Law and Roger Leisner for recorded portions. I'm Philip Babbage. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts, or if you'd like to make a comment or suggestion for future programs. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production funded by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. Our producers are David Barsamian, Philip Babbage, and Denise Grob. Our senior advisor is Norman Solomon, and our executive director is Peggy Law. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For everyone at Making Contact, thanks for listening.